Welcome back to another episode of the Wonderful Design Podcast. Today we have Nathan Auer, the head of design at the developer division at Microsoft. Nathan has over 25 years of experience as a design leader. Before he was the head of design at Microsoft, Nathan served as the vice president of user experience for Promethean and the director of design for Likewise, a startup founded by the Bill Gates private office. Prior to that, Nathan was actually back at Microsoft as the design director for Microsoft Whiteboards, Microsoft's education products. He's also led teams for Office, Xbox, Outlook, Cortana, and Exchange. Sounds like Bill can't get rid of you. He's also served as a liaison between Microsoft and University of Washington. He's mentored hundreds of students, and not to forget, he's also co-authored multiple patents with pen and touch interfaces. We're so excited to have you on the show. Nathan, how's it going?
It's going great. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I'm excited to be here and getting to chat with y'all.
Awesome. Well, I'm really excited that you're here.
Thank you so much. I'm flattered by that intro. Thank you. I should note I was one of the directors on Whiteboard. March Rogers was the lead director on that work and was amazing. Exceptional talent and somebody you should have on this show. He's fantastic.
Oh, awesome. I would love an intro. So every episode we start with a rapid fire round of questions. Nathan, are you ready?
Yeah.
Awesome. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Bellingham, Washington, in the beautiful Pacific Northwest.
Bellingham, Washington. And where are you now?
I am in Woodinville, Washington, also in the beautiful Pacific Northwest.
Which one do you like better?
That's hard. Bellingham was a lot of fun to stomp around as a kid, but Woodinville's been pretty fantastic. It's sort of the wine country of Washington, not where the grapes are growing, but where a lot of the wineries are, and it's beautiful out here.
Awesome. So what's a book that you think everyone should read?
That's not fair. Can I give you three?
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to give you three. For the page turner, everybody should read The Boys in the Boat, Daniel James Brown's true story of the University of Washington's rowing crew back in the 1936 Olympics. Remarkable. People told me to read that thing for probably a decade before I finally picked it up. And once I did, I instantly regretted not having read it before. It's just a fantastic book. For career, for people that are exploring their career, Dark Horse by Todd Rose and Ogi Ogis are just, it's a brilliant, brilliant book. And then my favorite number one business book for anybody that leads teams or works with other people, which is kind of everybody, is Peaceful Parent, Happy Kids by Dr. Laura Markham. And I know it's officially a parenting book, but if you skip through the bits that basically say all the things you shouldn't do, don't yell at your kids, don't hit your kids, et cetera, those sort of baseline things. After that, it's a conversation about how to be in relationships with others. And it's a note that, hey, your children are your children. They're never going to change who they are. And no amount of pressure or force or coercion will change who they are, which is exactly the same at work. Your coworkers are who they are. No amount of force or pressure or coercion is going to change who they are. And so it's a whole conversation about how to be in relationships with other humans. And it's my number one recommendation.
Gotcha. I've also heard that, in order to be a great leader, you're almost being that parent because you have to repeat what you've said multiple times before it really gets locked into someone's purview.
Interesting. Or into my own, right? Like so much of leading and teaching is learning, just constantly learning. Yeah.
So don't hit your coworkers, right?
don't hate your coworkers. Not enough time in this life for that.
What is one app you cannot live without?
Okay, again, the real answer on this is Messages in iOS. My family and I use it all the time. We have all our own little group conversations, including our broad family Wordle chat that we do every single morning together. But because this is a design podcast, I would say one of the best designed apps that I've seen recently is Future, which is a personal training app. They either send you a Apple Watch or you can use one if you already have one. And they do an amazing job of working with you in whatever context you're in with a personal trainer. The person that I was with is actually on the LA Lakers as a trainer. You get just some amazing people, but the app itself is brilliantly designed and does a great job of giving you videos and coaching you through and letting you listen to music while you do it. It's really cool. And I'm fairly critical of apps in general. And that one was exceptional.
Yeah, I bet. If you're in design, you have to be really critical. So I got to go check that one out because there's not too many apps out there. Yeah, there's not too many apps out there where I'm like, ooh, this is nice. So if you're seeing it, I'm going to definitely go and check it out.
It's really cool. Yeah. It's awesome. But the real answer is still messages. That's the one I can't live without every day.
Yeah, I was actually in the previous podcast, we were talking about how there's going to be a whole new category creation around messaging and text and just how we communicate, especially with the new generation, because people don't pick up the phone anymore. It's all about texting and messaging.
Yeah. No, agreed. It'll be an interesting future to see where this all goes.
Oh, yeah. So what do you think is the best invention of all time?
I think the real answer has to be antibiotics and vaccines, right? Like, and there's any number of amazing inventions in the world. There's a life-changing one. Personally, on a really small scale, I happen to be a watch nerd. And there's a thing called a NATO strap. This right here, this yellow thing that I'm wearing, it's a NATO strap that was developed first in 1973 for the British military. And it's a $10 at maybe worst strap of fabric that prevents you from losing your watch. A spring bar can pop. It makes it fit your wrist just kind of perfectly. Doesn't matter how big or small your wrist is. I think it's a brilliant invention. Just such a clever design. Hasn't functionally changed since 1973. And it's maybe one of the most popular watch accessories on the planet.
Wow, that's awesome. And I love your response because usually, you know, we've gotten like you said, vaccines and those kind of responses. So it's awesome that you got to show us your watch and learn a little history along the way.
Anybody who wants to dive deep with watches, just give me a ring, hit me up in the DMs, however you do it on this podcast. I will happily nerd out with everybody.
Awesome. And what's your favorite all-time accomplishment?
My favorite all-time accomplishment? Gosh. I think sincerely, not as the right reply, but sincerely, it's just all the careers that I've gotten to help people with, all the coaching and growing and mentoring and all the selfishly learning that I get out of that, because I learn things, I frankly learn often more from the people that I'm coaching and mentoring, however old they are, than they may be learning from me. But that's the stuff that I think is my biggest accomplishment. You know, you listed it, right? Like I got a bunch of patents. I've done a bunch of things. All of that's cool, but it's very ephemeral, right? Being able to have impact in people's lives, whether it's sort of coaching people through their careers, which I've done a bunch of, or, you know, building teams, you know, that are based on clear, positive cultures, like that's the stuff that's the real accomplishment. It has lasting human impact, which has lasting human impact on others, which has lasting human impact on others. Like that's the accomplishment.
I love that. I love that you mentioned it because one, I think we learn best when we're able to teach. And two, you know, at some point in your life, you get so fulfilled that you want to share that, right? By, you know, sharing your experiences and sharing with others. So to me, it just kind of signals that you have been very fulfilled in, at least from, you know, from my perspective, it seems like you've been very fulfilled with your career. And now you're getting to mentor hundreds of students and also just other people in their careers.
Well, and so much of it is about being open and vulnerable and sharing your mistakes too, and helping people either avoid them or at least, you know, have that free, for what it's worth, point of view of somebody else's experience that they can, you know, anchor off of and learn from or not, and go, oh, no, that's not applicable to the way I work. And that's equally useful.
Yeah, and I want to get to those mistakes too, because those are the fun topics. But our last rapid fire round question is, what's the biggest challenge that you're working on right now?
Building teams based on clear and positive cultures like that. Favorite accomplishment and biggest challenge.
So how do you do that? Let's dive in. How do you go about building that culture that people care about?
We do. I personally do a few different things that, again, have come through hard-earned wisdom and experience over the course of my career. One of the things that we do is we really screen and hire deliberately for people that are capable, curious, and kind, right? I wish I could call it the three C's or the three K's. Maybe I can call it the three plosives that sound like a K or a C, right? Capable is obviously, can you do the job, right? Are you capable of doing the tasks that you will be assigned to do at the level that you're assigned to do them? Curious is really about authentic curiosity, which is, I mean, we are all curious at some level, right? We are human beings. We want to explore our world around us and learn things. And authentic curiosity is about how are you going about learning and constantly retooling yourself and growing. What steps are you taking to go learn the things that you're interested in? It doesn't matter what you're interested in, but what steps are you actively, proactively taking as well? And that authentic curiosity tends to lead to empathy, and empathy tends to lead to authentic kindness. And kindness is not to be mixed with niceness, right? Niceness is great as well, but kindness also leads to candor and the ability to have both easy and difficult conversations with people authentically and with sort of clear intent about what it is that you're trying to accomplish, which is hopefully on the user's benefit, right? Like what it is that you're trying to do and why, and to be able to have those sorts of conversations. So we screen for capable, curious, and kind. In addition to that, we do regular psychological safety evaluations, both internally. So how do we as a team, how is the team feeling working up through the organization, up through Nathan? But also, how is the team feeling working with the partners, and how are the partners feeling working with us, right? And then we also do strengths and gaps work, which is around what's a good metaphor? Too much Apple TV Plus and watching Ted Lasso, but I'll use soccer, even though I don't know anything about soccer at all. But when you have a soccer team, you want to know what your and you're on that team. If you're a player, you want to know what your partner's strengths are and where they're weak, both what their strengths are so you can let them do that, right? If you have a striker who's really great with scoring when they're coming up the right side of the field, you want to clear that and make room for them and make sure that they can get that shot off. And if you know that that same striker is really weak on the left side of the field and tends to not be able to make shots, and they know that about themselves and can be okay with that, then you can go there and support, right? And so we do strengths and gaps work across the team so that we all know each other's strengths and how to support each other, and also know each other's gaps and how to support each other.
Yeah, I love the two C's and a K, kindness, capability, and curiosity. It's very aligned to our mission here at Wander as well. Our statement is a little bit different. For us, it's experience, educate, and grow. And it's got a similar philosophy in that we want people who are super curious and they're trying to go out and experience as much as possible because they have that insatiable curiosity of the world. And it's not just within professional realms, but personally too. And once you've experienced that, then we have a social responsibility to educate that to our team members, to our clients, and those people in our community as well. And then through the teaching, and we talked about this earlier, through the teaching, you then learn to grow faster because you're teaching what you've learned. So I love that you've shared that.
Yeah, there's no faster way to learn than teach, right? Like, there's just no faster way to learn. No faster way to be aware of how little you know about the topic until you try to teach it, however much of an expert you think you are.
Exactly. So I'm curious, on this topic of teaching and learning, like what are some of the most invaluable lessons that you've learned in your career that, it's become a theme for you that you're teaching this back to those that you're mentoring?
Yeah. There are a few things, right? There is, on the personal side, I have found for myself, this isn't true for everybody, but I've found for myself that every time I've chased career as opposed to passion and the thing that I love and enjoy doing or I want to do, but every time I've deliberately tried to chase career, my career has either plateaued or tanked. And every time I've chased the things that I am passionate about, that I love doing, my career has accelerated and at times even hockey sticked, right? And again, that's not true for everybody, but, you know, calling back to that book, Dark Horse by Todd Rose and Ogi Olgas, there is what seems to be a measurable truth to that. They've found that as well in their work. And they actually, in the last quarter of the book or so, the first sort of two thirds to three quarters is them making a defense of that, saying, here's why we believe this. And here are a bunch of examples that we've seen in the world around it. But the last chunk is really about, and if you want to have a career based on passion and things that you're excited about, that light you up, that every day feels less like work and more like something you love doing, here are specific steps that you can take to go explore that and try to learn if you're doing it or not.
Exactly. But it's so hard, right? Because so many people, they get stuck in thinking they have to do certain things or they have to grow their career in a certain direction because that's what society expects of them. And gosh, it takes people sometimes lifetime to actually get to that point of like, oh wait, like you're supposed to go after your passion and not what society expects of you. So I love that you bring that up.
Yeah. And I think that there's undoubtedly somebody listening to this right now who is saying, well, that's great, but I have a newborn child, or that's great, but I have dependents that see that I require, or I have a massive student debt that I have to pay, or that's great, but ... Right. And I have children. I get it. I have also had student debt. I get it. Right. Like I understand all of these notions. The thing that I would lean into there is find the passion in the thing that you are doing that is revenue generating for you. You can find things that excite you, right? My own background originally was theater and film. It was not this at all, right? And mostly theater. And on the theater side, there's a metaphor, a concept called the private audience. Have you heard of this? Do you know the private audience?
Private audience? No, I've never heard of this.
So this is especially for actors, but it's really for everybody across theater, but especially for actors when they're on stage. They are often actually performing for an audience that may or may not really be in the house at all, right? And that's their private audience, the thing that is motivating them to go do this thing in some way for some reason. And I found this as well when I did the OWA, the Outlook web app product early on. That was my second tour of duty at Microsoft. I had been here as a full-timer and I left and I was like, never going back to Microsoft. And then they called me up and said, hey, you come do this webmail thing. I was like, well, that's really exciting. And a lot of it for me was that private audience notion, right? Which was they wanted me to redo what was called the OWA basic client. It's what became the OWA light client before OWA itself became fully responsive and could actually sort of react on any platform for any context that it needed. And so we had them bifurcated at that time. But the OWA light client was for three audiences. One was for people on Mac, because we were building on these sort of different browsers architectures at the time. One was for people at Mac, one was for highly, highly performant contexts, and one was for blind and low vision users, right? And at the time, I had, my wife was nothing but Mac all the time. My brother was on the road all the time and constantly in low performance situations for bandwidth and needed to be able to still communicate. And my grandmother, who literally taught me computers, it was the bionic woman. She was dealing with, you know, her lenses being replaced and going through all sorts of things. I was like, oh, wow, like I can go build something really for people I care deeply about. And I was able to find passion in something that was to pay the bills and take care of my family, right? But still find passion that was deeply aligned and go do really cool work because of it.
That's like perfect alignment of, you know, finding passion in what you're doing. You couldn't have asked a better persona of who you're building it for. That's awesome. And yeah, and just last point on the passion, you know, how do you teach that to someone? Like, you know, I see you as being a very optimistic person. You know, here's a problem. Let's go solve it for the people that I love. But how do you translate that to someone who, you know, they got student debt and they got kids and they hate their job? How do they find passion in that?
Yeah, it's possible that they won't be able to. Let's be clear about that. And I am a generally very optimistic, glasses half full, joyful person. I have not been my whole life. There have been times where I have been deeply frustrated or disappointed in my situation as a very privileged, overpaid white man in this world, right? But still frustrated in my context at any given moment, as we all can be. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes you have to be able to identify for yourself, like what is actually a bad situation and work to progress into something that can be a positive situation while still taking care of your, you know, family, your commitments, the things that you need to. Sometimes it's about finding the balance outside of that, finding things. Lots of people talk about work-life balance, right? And for me, again, as a dad and parent, work-life balance for the longest time was about time at home versus time in the office. And I had at one point a college grad who had just joined the team and was doing, like, you know, 80-hour work weeks every week. And I was like, you gotta stop. You're gonna burn yourself out. Please stop. Did this two or three times with him. Finally, he came to me and said, hey, Nathan, listen, I'll stop if I really have to. If you're telling me to, I will stop. But please, please don't tell me to. I've been working my whole life to get to do this. This is the thing that energizes me. I've been dying to do this. Let me just do it, please. I can't believe I'm here. Let me do it, right? And I promise I'll stop when I start burning out. If it's not fun, I'll stop. But please just let me do it. And I had a total, I was like, right, of course. It's not time at home, time at the office. It is what recharges your battery and what depletes your battery. And sometimes work is going to deplete your battery, but sometimes it's going to really recharge your battery. And sometimes home is going to charge your battery, and some days it's going to deplete your battery, right? And so finding that work-life balance, I think that's really the trick, is be honest with yourself, because it's, you're only lying to yourself if you're not honest with yourself. There's nobody else you're lying to. Be honest with yourself about what you can find that will recharge your batteries in those contexts. And if you can't find it all in that context, find a way to compartmentalize, limit it, and go charge your battery somewhere else so that you have the energy to be, you know, have it drained while you're in that context. And strive for the next thing, work for the next thing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's about alignment, right? It's like when you are aligned to what you're passionate about, then as you said, it charges your battery instead of depleting it. And it sounds to me like the college grad you're working with, that sounds like every employer's dream. Like, you know, don't pull them away from the work.
Yeah, it was a really good life lesson for me. And it's one I still learn. I literally had one of my folks the other day who is more in my context, right? Has kids, all that, and was going, don't ask me to stop either. You've told us that story. Don't ask me to stop. I'm in this new context. I'm really excited.
Yeah. And just jumping back to the topic of theater, you mentioned you have a theater background. You also have a degree in theater. How did you get to product?
I don't have a degree in theater. That's the funny story. I am a high school dropout turned college dropout with no degree at all, and stumbled my way into product a bit. I needed a job. I had a child and needed to take care of them. And I had a colleague, an acquaintance, a good friend who was doing sales for a LAN-WAN, so local area network, wide area network implementation shop back at the start of sort of the networking days, right at the, like, 94, 95, right at the cusp of the internet starting to really explode across the world, right? And they needed an inside salesperson. And so I knew this person pretty well. I knew the hiring manager somewhat from the context. I knew that they were looking for something of a bombastic personality, a sales personality, which I'm not at all. So I used my theater and I walked in and he said, why should I hire you? And I said, because in 2 years I'll have your job, which I didn't believe or mean at all, but it got me the job. They brought me in. While I was there, I found a copy of Photoshop, which I taught myself. And I found a person had just joined and started helping me learn HTML just because it seemed like fun. I just was curious. I said, hey, show me how to do that. And of course, coming from theater, all your friends are either in bands or they're doing their own shows. So I used Photoshop and made some terrible album covers and made some terrible posters, but I learned some stuff while doing it. Eventually that company moved me from Bellingham, where I grew up, to Redmond, where Microsoft is. They then folded and laid me off. And 2 weeks later, I was at Microsoft in MSN, the very first round of MSN, back when they were trying to do huge content. This is where Expedia came out of, right? Like all of this massive sort of content type work as a web developer, because I'd self-taught myself HTML and knew enough about Photoshop. I could sort of cut stuff up and put it inside of tables and make things work. And I got to build the first ever online comic book with the guy who created Ren and Stimpy, John Chris Felucci. Like, got to do all sorts of crazy stuff. It was super fun. Emeril Lagasse, the first Food Network work. It was pretty cool times. But that's how I stumbled my way into it. And I still had moments years later. I remember in OWA, in fact, years later, I'm working in OWA. People have seen some of my work. The folks over in Office proper and Outlook was separate from OWA at that time. It was over in Office. But some really killer designers had seen some of my work, and we're in a meeting and they wanted to collaborate. And they're like, hey, will you come do some explorations with us? Let's do some stuff together. I was like, that sounds great. And they're like, yeah, we'll just mood board some stuff. And I'm sitting across the table behind my laptop, looking up the word mood board while nodding, going, yeah, I'd love to. This sounds great. Happy to. I can't wait to mood board with you all. Lots and lots of them.
That sounds like so much fun. That actually sounds so much fun. So you went from theater to designing album covers to MSN, and now looking up what mood board means as you're doing it. That sounds like such a fun career change. Would you say that there's any relation between what you've learned in theater and how you're leading product now?
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. It's interesting, both on the teams management side and on the product side. And so like on the product side itself, I actually see user experience more as a proscenium stage than I do as film. I know lots of people look at it as film and television, but really in film and television, you have total control of everything. So unless it's a cutscene in a video game, you do not have total control of everything in a user experience, right? You are presenting lots of information, and you're trying to do good hierarchy of that information. You're presenting lots of information, and then the user gets to decide how they interact and what they need at what time. And frankly, the proscenium in theater is the same thing. You have to light it in certain, you have all the actors on stage, you have all these set pieces, you have all sorts of stuff, and then you get to light it in certain ways or bring in scenery at certain times and bring it out at certain times to try to draw the eye, to try to get the audience to come along with you and to see this moment that you're really hoping they see, right? And that's user experience to me, right? I think theater is very tightly aligned with that. And then on the sort of the way things work, the business side of it, I think that theater, and especially the current sort of gig economy, the new way that teams are working, I think there's a lot to be learned from that. I have a few folks on my team that came from theater. In the theater, you quite regularly spin up a new idea. You hire a bunch of people, quite often people that you've worked with before and that you know and maybe even social and friendly with. And then you fire them all and you go on to the next project, right? And it's a regular reoccurring thing. And we have in sort of modern business world, we have a lot of things that doesn't work with, right? Like never hire a friend. Or if you hire people, don't become friends with them, right? All these sorts of old mantras around that I have found that once I got past that and started becoming friendly with all the people that work with me and really getting to know them, it let me really get to care about them. It let them understand who I am as a leader and see that I'm an authentic person, that I'm not capable of mistakes just like everybody else, that I'm not some climber that's just out here trying to advance my career for my sake, right? Like you get this sort of true, authentic idea of who the community is. And I think that theater has a lot to teach us in that, both on the business side and, again, on the user experience side.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a really long-winded answer to your question.
So long story short, yes, theater definitely contributes to what you've learned in product and product leadership. And I agree with what you mentioned. You know, I think when people say like you can't be friends with, you know, people that you've worked or don't hire friends, I think those are all limiting beliefs of how people used to work. But at least in my personal experience, I find that some of my best friends today are those that I met professionally. And I actually love and enjoy working with friends because I'm able to be a lot more upfront about expectations than I would if it's someone that I just, you know, started working with right off the bat. So yeah,
I think there's an assumption. There's a true, I don't want to gloss over the real risk. There's a real risk that there will be some bad actors in the world that will hire friends and then, you know, just elevate them and do all these things, right? Like that's a very real risk. I don't want to sort of, you know, gloss over that. I think that the majority of the time, just by the way, as it's a very real risk that you'll hire people in this remote economy and they just won't be able to work. Again, the majority of the time in this remote economy, people are overworking. We know it. We see the data. People are having a hard time not working. That's the problem. Not people not working. The problem is people overworking. And I think the same thing winds up being true in the friend context, whether it's a hiring of a friend or getting to know somebody and becoming friendly. What generally happens is actually those people get a shorthand and they get crisper about things. And at the same time, I think people find themselves going a little harder on those people, right? Going, I have this higher expectation. I know you, I believe in you. So I know you can do more and I expect more of you, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, that line, I expect more of you. That's a killer. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is terrible. Which is actually, that's not a great thing. That's a bad thing. We should know people. Back to peaceful parents, peaceful parent, happy kids. We should know our other in some way. We should know what they are capable of. We should have appropriately high expectations of everybody, right? Because people tend to rise to those, but we should not expect more of than we do of any of their peers.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And let's migrate a little bit more over to design. I'm curious what is your design philosophy?
Oh, design philosophy. Now I have to be pithy. Design is a verb. My design philosophy is design is a verb. It is not something that it's not something that we hold just to us. It is not, we are the only people that can do it, right? If we are the only people that can do it, then I could never have done it. And I could never have come into this career, right? Mm-hmm. Design is a verb that requires all of us collectively doing it. And so it requires, yes, the people with design in their title, but it also requires the people with research in their title and the people with marketing in their title and the people with PM in their title and the people with engineering in their title, right? Like it requires all of us to successfully design things. It is not something that any of us do on our own. There are some very specific areas of deep expertise that all of us go out and study and learn around engineering, around getting your MBA and driving product, around user research and being non-biased, which I'm terrible at. I'm the worst user researcher. I'm the guy behind the mirror just yelling, hit the button. Right, we all go and learn specific things, and design has a plethora of that. And it is a broad, broad term, right? And so you have things like grid and typography and color theory that is still a verb. It's still relational. We need feedback and input from our customers and our stakeholders. But we have people that really know how to do it, and we will trust them and empower them to do it. And then we have things like user experience where, yeah, we've done lots and lots of education, either real world or in school or both. But ultimately, it's really our customer that's going to tell us if it's right or not. And they will tell us through usage. And we need to learn how to measure and understand that usage. And we need to learn the difference between, now I'm going to date myself, the Pepsi challenge, where Coke went out and drove the Pepsi challenge And by doing these little simple taste tests the early days, they decided, oh, we should make new Coke. Nobody likes Coca-Cola. We should make new Coke. As you probably know, nobody drinks new Coke. It doesn't even exist anymore because they were testing the wrong thing. They were just testing that first moment as opposed to longitudinal, right? There's a great story in that in Malcolm Gladwell's, one of his earlier books, not Blink, but anyways, one of his early books that he tells a great story around that. But anyway, so the point there being that there is real expertise in the space, but ultimately design is a verb. It's something we all have to come together to collaborate on and to deliver for our customers.
How do you manage that though? Because, you know, there are certain organizations where design has always kind of been at the back, like afterthought, right? Now,
Don't say seat at the table.
Exactly. They say, you know, I can have a seat at the table. Like, you know.
Don't say it. That is my pet peeve. I hate design has a seat at the table. That's the worst.
So yeah, one, why is that a pet peeve of yours? And then, you know, to get to my original question, how do you manage that? How do you get organizations where that saying design has a seat at the table, how do you get them to be a little bit more open about we need a design for the customers and be more design centric?
Yeah. I think this kind of goes back to your earlier question as well, that I think I went on a bit of a tangent on, but this design as a verb is part of this, which is, I think at times we design are guilty of thinking we're the only ones that are thinking about the customer. And in reality, every discipline thinks they're building for the customer. Every discipline does. Not thinks like as in, and they're wrong. They are sincerely building for the customer, right? There's this really useful friction that should be part of every product group, right? And if you use design, I'm going to lump research into design. I'm going to lump industrial design and visual. I'm going to lump all of it into one big category called design. I'll lump all full stack and front end and just all engineers into one big bucket called engineering, and all the PMs, whether they're program managers, product managers, TPMs, I'll lump that all into one bucket. So we'll have three areas, okay? Engineering.
Is that one seat at the table as you're lumping them all in?
No, this isn't seat at the table. We'll get back to seat at the table in a minute. Okay. I'll hit on my pet peeve. But to your question about how do you get us all working for the customer? Everybody already believes they're working for the customer. That is their intent. And you may have an engineer who is frankly building to solve their own problem, something that's hard for them to do and they wish it was easier. Lots of great products in this world came about because somebody tried to build something to make their life easier and it turned out everybody else also needed it. That is building for the customer. Now, we need to go learn if they are actually the target customer for that scenario, but they are building for the customer and they're passionate about it. You have the PMs who, you know, they have their business outlook on this of going and actually knowing who the customer is, who's going to buy this product, right? Now, they may be thinking about who's going to purchase the product more than who's going to be made to use the product in large enterprise offerings, but they are still thinking about a customer that, frankly, we in design, who are almost always thinking just about the end user, may not be thinking about, that we need to go design and solve, right? And so there's this necessary healthy friction between those three that have to exist. I think about it the same way that if you're riding a bike that was powered by superconductors and you're on a sheet of ice floating above that sheet of ice and you're pedaling, it doesn't matter how hard you pedal, you're never going to go anywhere because there's no friction, there's no contact. You need the tire to meet the road, right? You need the chain pulling on the gears. You have to have that friction to move. And so the critical piece on the bike is that it's pointed in the same direction. And I think that's true of product teams as well, which is we all need to be pointed in the same direction. We all need to have a shared notion of truth. And then we all need to go try to do the thing that we're good at, which is PMs want to have the first mover's advantage, right? They want to be at market first, and they're right. If you don't have the first mover's advantage, you're really going to risk a lot of market share. Engineers want to have the most stable and robust possible system because they don't want to get the call in the middle of the night telling them that it fell over, right? Like that's literal human pain for them that I think we can all be empathetic to. And we also don't want that to fall over on the customer, right? They want it to be robust and then never touch it again. Again, I'm making gross generalizations here. There are many engineers who love to throw away code and just keep reinventing as well. Design in general wants to keep iterating and iterating and iterating until it's perfect, right? And if you're in an org that is too far to any of those, if you're too far to the engineering side, you'll have things that are really robust that nobody uses. If you're too far to the PM side, you'll have things that ship incredibly fast and get out there, but aren't robust and fall over and aren't well thought out and therefore lose market share, go against their own goal. And if you're too far to the design side, you're never going to ship anything. It'll just sit and never, ever, 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 ever ship, right? And so you need that healthy tension between all of them. That's critical. And so once you look at it through, hey, everybody's already thinking about the customer. Really, now your goal is, how do you get to a common sense of the customer? And how do you get there in a way that people can subscribe to it and believe in it? And that's where things like UXR come in. That's where Monty Hammontree is one of my peers. He and his crew have written whole books on this thing called the Hypothesis Progression Framework, HPF, which is a great way for teams to be able to go out and really explore and learn and say, hey, I have this hypothesis. Was it validated? Was it invalidated? Does it need more information? Let's go learn about our customers and find out if we're really solving problems. And so once you have that shared notion, now we can all drive, again, with useful friction, because I'm going to want it nicer, and PM's going to want it faster, and engineer's going to want it more stable, with useful friction to get something out the door.
Yeah, in an ideal world, that sounds like the perfect formula, right? You have the friction between the engineering, the product managers, and the designers. Oftentimes, we see a lot of organizations that are skewed one direction or another, right? They either say, oh, we're super design centric. And as you said, they get stuck in iteration after iteration. Or we've also seen organizations where it's run by engineering. Like things don't even run to design. It just gets shipped off right away. So just trying to nail down the point of like, how, if an organization is skewed one direction or another, how can you help them like, or how can they have that right balance of that triad of friction?
Yeah, the thing that we do is we go and look for partners that have an appetite for it already. And then you show by example, right? So I go and find my peers in engineering and PM, and we go and find folks that are like-minded, all working on a similar product already, right? It's hard to just find one discipline peer somewhere and a different discipline peer somewhere else. But you go and find like-minded, and then you drive culture change by example, which is we all fund and invest in those areas.
I love that. My last, I guess, or last question, I want to talk about your time at Microsoft, because you've been in and out. What is happening in these times?
Oh, what is happening? Yeah. Well, so it's interesting. The first time I started my career at Microsoft, 95 was MSN, is where I started my career as a contractor. And it was funny, every time I did something, you know, I'd fly down to LA or whatnot with my producer to help, you know, set up a show, meeting with celebrities or whatever. I'd get back and suddenly contractors were no longer allowed to do that thing that I did. So I kept learning through that. Finally, I jumped back and forth out of contracting there and into, some fintech work and other things. Finally went full-time on an incubation project that became the rules engine inside of BizTalk rules engine, BizTalk RE. And the incubation project was great. They asked to convert me. I converted over to full-time. I said, great, I'd love to be a designer. They said, yeah, no, really, we don't have design as a core discipline. You can be a PM or an engineer. What do you want to be? And I was like, oh, I guess I'll be a PM. That's closer to design. Became a PM. That was all great until we got acquired officially by BizTalk, internal acquisition, right? Like we were in incubation, internally acquired. And then what happened was, well, I was a PM and therefore I needed to be a technical PM. And if I wasn't a technical PM, then I had no business being there. And that was hard. That was really hard for me. That had nothing to do with what I thought I wanted to do or how to do it. And so I left Microsoft and I was never coming back to Microsoft. And went off and did some other stuff for a while. And then, like I mentioned before, I got the call about doing OWA. Thought it sounded like a lot of fun. Came on contract, did a year on contract doing the light client. And again, they, at the end of that contract, it's a 1-year contract, at the end of that, they said, hey, let's convert you. We want to keep you here. And I said, great, make me a designer. And they said, we don't really have a role for a designer, but we'd love to have you be a PM. And I said, no. Well, I did, though. I had the learning now. And I said, no, if I come in, I'll be a designer. Thank you very much. You know, and we kind of went back and forth, and they were correct. I would have been a great PM. I authored tons of specs while I was there. I led teams while I was there as essentially a PM, right? Like I reported up through the PM org basically the whole time I was there. I would have been a great PM inside of Exchange. It's totally true. But I was like, no, like I'm a designer. That's what I do. And so we went back and forth, and finally, like literally it came down to basically the last day on a Friday. We finally got all the paperwork signed. Everything was good. Ended my contract. And I started as a designer at Microsoft on the next Monday. And then I had a really a 15-year journey doing lots of different things. Outlook and OWA, as I talked about before, Office, brief stint as ACD, trying to figure out what all of Office would sort of feel like for color and sort of the vibe of it. A brief stint in Cortana, because I'm not a conceptual designer, trying to do some strength training for myself around conceptual designing and how do we make Cortana a more trusting entity without having earned it yet, right? Like all sorts of fun stuff there, Xbox. And as you had mentioned before, building and standing up and creating the design team for Microsoft's worldwide education offering. And then moving over to as a IC director, over envisioning on the whiteboard side, working with March Rogers. I would say a little before, probably just post Cortana, a little before moving over to the education side, I hit my 10-year anniversary mark and I was getting pretty crispy. And I remember being in a meeting of extended leadership and some of the things they were talking about me, that personally, I was feeling like, man, we've been talking about this a long time. You know, is this, and coming back and chatting with my wife going, man, we've been talking about this a long time. And she was like, hey, maybe you need to do something else. Maybe it's time to go do something else. And it took me a little longer to go, no, you're right. It's time to go do something else. Like I've just 15 years. I'd finally hit a 15-year stint. I was like, time to go do something else. And I'd been doing startups inside of Microsoft for basically over a decade, but all of them were VC of goodwill. You would go to a vice president you already knew or a president you already knew, and you'd get funded or you wouldn't. And if you didn't get funded, that's fine. You still have a job. You're in office. It's great. I wanted to go really learn about actual startup world. And so I didn't want to just leave to leave. I wanted to go to something, go towards something, right? Not just leave something. And so I went and joined Likewise, which was a startup, again, run by a lot of former Microsofties, funded out of Gates Venture, out of Bill Gates's private office. But I got to learn a whole lot about how to experiment with product via social media, not just with brand via social media. Got to learn a whole lot about scaling and empowering teams. And when I decided to jump back into the enterprise, I did chat with developer division, funny enough, chatted with bunch of other folks, wound up going over to Promethean and taking the VP role there, and then wound up with some very flattering conversations asking me if I'd be interested in coming and taking the head of design role at DevDiv, and was frankly, the team is so remarkably egoless and such a learning culture, not just design, like the engineering team in developer division, the PM team in developer division is so just, man, like they just want to learn and they want to grow. And I was incredibly attracted to that. And I was incredibly embarrassed to go to my CPO at Promethean and tell him that, hey, I know I haven't been here long, but I'm going to go take this opportunity because I don't know how to say no. And he laughed because he was also taking another opportunity. So I didn't feel quite as heartbroken at that point wound up going and joining developer division. But, you know, that's what has brought me back a few times now. It's the people. It's the scale of opportunity, the impact that you have on real humans in the world. There's not many places like that in the world. And the culture at Microsoft is so positive. You know, I have the capable, curious kind. Microsoft has model coach care, right? Like they have their three as well. The things that we all do as managers, they are I'm not a representative of the company. I have left the company twice. I am not here as a representative. I'm just here on my own. But Microsoft does have a remarkable culture that I'd be hard pressed not to sing the praises of.
Yeah. And going back to what we were talking about earlier, passion, you know, sometimes that comes out of the people that you work with. Like if you're surrounded by people who are passionate about learning, it becomes contagious, right? And even if you're not passionate about what it is that you're doing in that particular moment, if you're inspired by those people, the people around you, it's going to keep you around. You're going to want to keep growing with them too. And it sounds like that's what you're doing at Microsoft right now.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. It's been a lot of fun. I realized, because I think the listeners will be disappointed after my vitriol around don't offer me a seat at the table, that I did not close the loop on that. So let me close loop.
Please do.
On why my pet peeve.
Why is that such a big pet peeve of yours? If someone says design has a seat at the table, go for it.
Thank you. Thank you for the platform to express what I hope is not seen as a ridiculous opinion. Why I hate it is because it is only half of the sentence. It is not, hey, design now has a seat at the table, period. It is actually, hey, design now has a seat at the table, dot, dot, dot. Now prove you deserve it. Now what are you gonna do with it? Now show us some value, right? That's really what the full sentence is. I don't know anybody that wants to be hired into a job and be told, hey, you're here, now show you deserve it. Prove you have value, right? Like that's just, it's totally the wrong metaphor. If design has a seat at the table, now you need to prove you have value. So does engineering, so does PM. Everybody has to prove they have value there. That's not why we're there. There's only one seat at the table, or there should only be one seat at the table. And that is a seat at the table for the customer. That's the only seat. The seat at the table for the customer, that's it. The rest of us have to run our restaurant. We have to run our business. We have to advertise and get people to even know we exist. We have to get people through the front door with a delightful experience that they are excited to be there. We have to get them to their table. We have to make them feel like they are cared about in the way we are actually caring about them. And we have to run the back of the house in a clean, efficient, beautiful way. And so I'd much rather you say, hey, you know what? We've been making pastries here for a long time, but we really need to hire a pastry chef, right? We make some okay pastries, but man, if we had a pastry chef, we could make some killer pastries. And at that point, you know you need a pastry chef. You understand the value the pastry chef brings. It's not a question of, hey, now you're a pastry chef and you're here, show you deserve it. You already know why you hired, right? That's what we should be looking at. One seat at the table. I would love to be your pastry chef. That'd be a lot of fun.
I love all these metaphors that you've been bringing to today's conversation, starting from the soccer to, you know, the bicycle. And now, and it makes so much sense what you just described of the customer is the only one that has the seat at the table. Everyone else, like, get to work. We're serving the customer. And we got to bring the best experience for that one customer or that one person that's actually sitting at the table. So thank you so much for sharing that. I love it.
You are welcome. I didn't want to leave anybody disappointed with why was Nathan going on a rampage and then he never talked about it.
Yeah. Exactly. So we are coming up on time, but I want to ask you, is there any advice or anything else that you would like to share with the design community that's important to you?
Oh, gosh. Keep doing amazing work. Keep being you. Don't let people make you not be you. Stay yourself. I think so often we shape ourselves to meet the situation. We especially, you know, we see it in, all the various D&I contexts, right?
trying to fit who you are to that context. And it's true, I think, for design in a very special way when it comes to this world of technology, right? When we talk about user experience, when we talk about partnering with engineering and PM, it's generally not the power position. And again, being the power position has its own risks as well. It's generally not the power position. And I think a lot of people strive to fit in. And I think it's probably better to strive to be in a healthy relationship.
Exactly. At some point, the mask is going to slip off. So it's, you know, just don't wear the mask in the first place. Be fully authentic and show up as you are. I love that.
Right. Be yourself. Be your authentic self. Don't ask other people to change, but also don't change who you are. Find the place in between.
Yeah. Well, Nathan, thank you so much for your time today. I learned a lot. I love this conversation that we had. If somebody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way to reach you?
Oh, you can hit me at LinkedIn. I'm there. Nathan Auer. You'll find me. I do not do a lot of the socials, unfortunately. I think you'll find an Instagram account with me there, but I update it maybe once every 3 or 4 months at the best. But come hit me up on LinkedIn. I'd love to chat.
Awesome. So LinkedIn at Nathan Auer, right?
Oh, and it's A-U-E-R. It's funky, right? Sorry. It's at Nathan Auer, A-U-E-R. It's like Bauer without the B. It's a lot of vowels in the row. It's very confusing.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Nathan, for being on the show today.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for having me.
Well, stay tuned for more episodes on design, product management, and innovation. Next week, we'll be interviewing Ray Fambro, product manager at Mozilla Firefox. Until then, experience, educate, and grow to live your best lives. Thank you, everyone.